agree with them on, and then, well, the first thing I wanted to do then was to take care of the rest of the agenda and then spend more time on the ones we might have disagreed on, but I guess at this point it'd be better to just start pulling out ones we may disagree on. So would it be easier, members, to work off the old agenda if you had anything marked that way, or to work off the new agenda and just work on names as we were going through things?
I just, Mr. Chairman, I just pulled out the old agenda and put the new one in, so
okay.
I'm on the new one. I don't know about
Well, I had marked specific names on the old agenda that I wanted to talk about, and well, the first thing actually I wanted to talk about kind of goes over the whole committee, because, you know, it occurred to me as I was going through some of these that some of these are repeat people, and I was wondering if it's legal for us to get information about folks if they tend to show up in every claims committee agenda, because as we're looking through there and some of these names sound familiar, it just, I guess I already, so I'll say that I have a bias that I'm, you know, I think some people are going to waste taxpayer money and time, and that's their gig. They have nothing better to do, and I think we should know as members of the committee and subsequent members of the committee if these people are constantly filing claims against the state. Not that that would should bias the way we look at it, but we should understand, because one in particular in here is extremely lengthy, and I believe that was a person that filed a claim last time as well. And I think somebody else outside of our purview may want to look at those if they have continuous claims, so that we don't tend to, like I said, I'm admitting a prejudice. I don't want to look at things prejudicial, so I'd rather have somebody else, another set of eyes, especially when they're as lengthy with these lawsuits and things filed along with or the way they come to us as a lawsuit type of presentation. That's not something, I'm not an attorney. I don't know how to look through some of those specific types of items. The other things are pretty simple. They give us their, you know, both sides kind of the evidence, the inventory, and
Mr. Chairman, those matters that you have some concern about that you just described, is there anything to say we can't simply continue the hearing on those issues or those matters and have that second set of eyes look at it between now and the next time we get together? I'm not aware of anything says we can't do that.
No, I think we probably could. I didn't know how other members felt, but it's as I'm reading through some of it, it just seems like some people purposely, you know, go on literally ad nauseum. So I want to make sure that I'm not, because I feel that way, I want to make sure I'm not missing something that may be accurate. But honestly, you kind of get that way about some of this stuff.
Mr. Chairman, I think that you raised a legitimate point. I think, well, if you look at rules, task the subcommittee is to determine whether equity is involved, place a moral obligation on the state to give relief. So if a person is frequently submitting lengthy and frivolous claims, it could be a factor that goes to the credibility of the claimant. And since we don't have rules that are very precise, but we are, you know, just follow principles of equity, there's no reason we couldn't consider that.
Okay, great point. I appreciate that, Representative Wardlaw. So that was one thing I just had a comment on. But otherwise, was there items specifically? Senator Wieger, did you have any items you wanted to pull out? Or?
Well, I know that.
Maybe we should kind of mark off and see if our agendas match up in terms of.
Number 29, Robert Smith, I believe that representative.
That's on the original agenda.
Simon
members.
Wanted that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Most of my questions had to do with
okay.
Sherburne Soil and Water District. I could just ask one question. Well, when we went, it's not going to be before us, so maybe I just direct it to staff then. Or
I think you could direct it to staff to make sure that when it comes back, okay, we get any information that you think might be lacking on the file, Senator. Senator Newman, did you have any specific ones you wanted to?
No, to be real honest, the questions that I had revolved around the same issue that Senator Wieger had, the Sherburne Soil and Water. So other than that, no.
Okay. And Representative Wardlaw, any specifics?
Actually, the same for me. The Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District is where I had to
okay.
Bulk my questions. And then
So we all had basically the same, but I wanted some other ones to talk about. So I think it's a good time to talk about them as long as we don't have a...
Mr. Chairman, there were three additional DOC property claims that I thought the committee might want to discuss. One was number 5, Ricky DeLeon.
On the new
On the new agenda.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And number 10, Orville Helton.
And I had that one marked off as well.
And you had that one marked off, I believe, as well.
Yes.
And 13, Hollis Larson. These were
Hollis
ones
Larson.
Where I did have some questions.
And it was Hollis Larson that was one of those lengthy, I believe.
Yes, it was. It was one of the more the lengthier ones. The other... Another lengthier one was pulled off the agenda, Darwin Battle, and I had some questions about that one for the department, and Ms. Nicole Lind, who just arrived, actually talked to the folks back in the facility, and they actually found his property. They thought it had been disposed, and they found it. So that's the reason why that one was withdrawn.
Great.
Along with the Yanez case where Ms. Lind determined to pay for some tennis shoes. So
Okay. Those
two have been totally withdrawn and do not need to be considered at all.
All right. Well, then, members, I have some other questions. We can start with item number 5.
We do have people to testify on the DHS claims. Did you want to take those two first?
Well, if we can find Representative Smith, I guess I'd rather have that testimony with
okay.
him present as well. So, okay. So,
yep.
Ricky DeLeon. Let's see if I can. And another thing I had just mentioned to Ms. Timmons, if we could possibly have little tabs put on the outsides of these. I know it, even not so much even having the revenue and it split up like that, but some tabs to match the numbers so that we could easily go to the ones we're thinking of in terms of that. So Ricky DeLeon was by, right by this one. Okay. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to present this claim?
Yes, please, Ms. Timmons.
Mr. Chairman, before we start, where do we find it in this?
I'm
having the same problem.
They are alphabetical. So
they're alphabetical?
Yes.
Under the DOC property.
It still isn't necessarily easy since some have more paperwork than others.
Right.
It's about an eighth of an inch. Yeah.
More helpful, yeah, really.
Yeah. I like that.
Okay.
Where is it from?
Got the blue tab.
I got Defoe.
Yeah.
Where are we from Defoe?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the next one.
The next one after
Defoe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I found it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I spent several years observing while Mr. Lindeke was counsel for the Subcommittee on Claims, and one of the things that I did notice as a pattern is that subcommittee claims members often wanted to talk about a property case when the item lost was something with sentimental value that really could not easily be replaced by paying damages. And so I did suggest that we hear this Ricky DeLeon claim in that the claimant was claiming some lost consumable items which aren't inventoried and I think clearly should be denied. He also claimed that he lost a wedding band, a silver wedding band, and there was at least one inventory that showed he did have a wedding band, but the more recent inventory after the pack up showed that it was not present. And so the questions I had for Ms. Lind from the DOC really related to whether or not there are any special rules about property that has this type of sentimental value, and that was really the question I thought on this particular claim.
Good afternoon, and I apologize because I cannot see your name tags. Sorry. But regarding this claim, Mr. Chair, the offenders are solely responsible for their personal property, and what he had alleged was that he took his claim off and put it in a tin cup with coins. He claimed that he took it off when he went to work, and then he came back and he went to segregation, and staff came in and packed up his property. If he would have had the gold ring in the coins, he should have put it in a footlocker because offenders are responsible for securing all of their personal property. So if he has this ring and the coins, they should always be put in his footlocker because this was a double occupancy cell. So he was solely responsible for taking care of his ring. And it wasn't inventoried on the inventory because the staff probably... It either wasn't in the cup like he stated, or staff didn't go through the coins that were in the cup.
So, Ms. Lind, is it when somebody does have coins or money, is it normal that the staff wouldn't go through to see how much that somebody might have had and just in case there was a claim against that sort of thing?
Normally they wouldn't. They would just put the container in with the property that the offender has.
Okay. Any members have any questions? That one got me thinking because that's what I'm always looking at is the inventory sheets and the, you know, how did it show up, but I don't know what to think, and I guess I do have questions about other cases in terms of folks securing their items. But I guess we have another claim in here for, I think it was $19.75 of coins that not only didn't get inventory, disappeared. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I'm looking at this claim on this, I think the second page of his claim, date when alleged loss or damage occurred, July 7th, 2010 through October 1st, 2010. I assume that means sometime during that period. Date when it's first reported, October 7th, 2010. When I was looking at the rules and, you know, never having gone through this claims committee before, there is a rule in dealing with DOC claims that this would be on the second page of the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. It says that we are not to consider if the inmate didn't notify the Department of Corrections within 24 hours of the loss or when he returned to the place where the property was located. Now, just at first blush, when I look at that rule, it tells me procedurally we shouldn't even be considering the claim if he didn't report it for 6 days after he felt that it was lost. So procedurally, Mr. Chairman, should we even be considering this claim given that rule? Am I reading the rule correctly?
Oh, Senator Newman and the committee members, that was really the key to why I did not ask to pull this one out. I thought if it was really truly a wedding band that was of sentimental value, or even a wedding band period, you would think somebody would notice something of that nature missing immediately. So it was that time lapse that was the reason I didn't pull this one out as being something I would want to look at. But I paid more attention to it in terms of details because of it being that kind of an item that Mr. Lindeke given us a history of looking at those sorts of things in more detail.
Exactly. And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lynn did supply us in that packet with the new agenda. There is some additional information about the policies, the DOC policies about securing one's property. Mm-hmm. And my question really was, are there different policies for items that you might wear on your person, like a ring or a watch? And it does not look to me like there is any distinction between one type of property or another. So Ms. Lynn did supply that additional information for the subcommittee.
No, it seemed like the fun property that disappeared all the time was the sweatpants and the hot pots. I don't know if somebody's seen that. That was a seemed to be the items of choice. I don't know how that works, but so I guess any more members or questions, members? No, so we'll move past that one. I guess we can't agree or not agree till we have a quorum. But I wanted to move on to item 10. Orville Helton.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a claim in which it seems pretty clear that the claimant's TV was damaged by his cellmate, and it was, you know, so often when you read these claims, it's likely that the cellmate took the property that was claimed to be lost. Here it seemed pretty straightforward that the cellmate poured water on the television and damaged it, and there seemed to be some corroborating evidence that one of the guards needed to come and help clean up the water. And so while I think it's pretty clear that this cellmate, this third party, did the damage and it's not a direct result of any staff negligence, there are sufficient problems that come up with this double bunking that I thought it would be good to hear what the policies are when cellmates really do not get along, when they're resorting to blows or intentionally damaging each other's property. And so perhaps Ms. Lind could.
Mr. Chair, when offenders figure out that they're not compatible with their cellmate, they are immediately to notify staff, and then we will work around our policies. And I did provide several policies in regards to incompatibility with their cellmates. I don't know if you have a copy of that. I did make copies if you would.
Well, the question more to me, I think when I read through this, you were talking about, or someplace in it, it said that the inmate was to secure the television when he went to work. And so I called a number of folks that work at the different facilities and asked them if it was possible to secure a television in whether it was the lockers were large enough. And the general answer was no. Generally, it's not available. So that's why I had the question on this one was if, in fact, the person is having these problems but cannot secure their property, I think it's reasonable for someone to still assume that when they come back that property should be protected.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And the only thing that I can say about that is as soon as they find out that they're incompatible with their cellmate, they're required to notify us.
And Ms. Lind, could you speculate then why, even if they didn't notify someone, why a claim would be denied if someone's property was damaged that they were not able to secure when they're not?
According to the rules, it states that there has to be an act or omission of a staff member, and we just claim that the staff member didn't. It wasn't an omission of a staff member because another offender damaged the offender's property.
Well, I guess, members, I'm not going to buy that because I think, again, if an inmate is not able to secure a piece of property, there should be a reasonable assurance that property should somehow be able to be protected. Televisions are not cheap, and especially for folks that are incarcerated. So, Representative Wardlow.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If there's no way to secure the television or personal property like that, if the inmate can't secure it, then the Department of Corrections can't secure it either.
But
necessarily, and I don't think that the state should. There's no moral obligation on the state to protect the personal property of an inmate beyond what a person can reasonably do to protect their property. And I think that if there's no act or omission on the part of the Department of Corrections here that directly results in damage, I don't think we can actually go forward with a claim like this.
Fair enough, Representative, but I disagree with you. I think there is an omission to protect someone's property when it is in a close proximity of an area that is guarded, or they should have the ability to secure that property, because if you go through every one of these claims, the issue is if something disappears, it's the responsibility of the inmate to secure that property. So if you're going to use that as your reason or the omission part, then you dang well better give them some place to secure the property. Otherwise, that then you wipe out that on the rest of the cases as well. Representative?
Sure. Just for an item like a television, that can't be easily secured. I would say that the inmate is assuming the risk that there could be damage to the television by bringing it into that environment.
Well, again, point well taken, Representative. But again, the folks I talked to at the different facilities said that that shouldn't be the case, that there should be a reasonable assurance by staff that that could be protected. Things like televisions could be protected or carted off somewhere else. Senator Newman?
Mr. Chairman, in reading the comments on the Department of Recommendations sheet, it says it seems evident that the claimant's TV was damaged by a cellmate by pouring water on it. Under those circumstances, that strikes me as being an intentional act in which Mr. Helton may have a claim against his cellmate, but I don't see any justification of making a claim against the state of Minnesota for the ineffective criminal act of somebody else.
Well,
Mr.
Again,
Chair, excuse me.
Ms. Lind.
There is no evidence to say that that offender didn't do that to his own television. You know, he could always allege that his cellmate did it, and he might have spilled a glass of water on it just trying to get us to pay for the TV.
Well, I guess, Ms. Lind, we have no evidence that DOC didn't do it either, but on purpose. And again, I'm looking at your letter here, dated September 27, 2011. It says specifically, you have been provided with the means to secure all your property in lockable space in your cell, but did not utilize the option. And I have been told by other staff and as well as a former commissioner that that's, you're not given the ability to lock a television generally, but you're using that in this letter. And if that's not the case, then why is it in the letter?
Mr. Chair, I need to look at my letter here.
Maybe I take some of these things more serious, but I did contact three folks that work in facilities and a former commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I think with alleging with the TV space, I guess it depends upon what size of TVs that the offenders purchase. If they purchase a 12-inch TV, that could probably fit into the storage container. The Department of Corrections, we can't be responsible for what the offenders do within their cells. We don't have cameras in the cells.
Well, members, I'm going to ask then this one be held over for more information from both parties, because actually someone also told me it was just as likely that somebody, a guard that was mad at the offender could have just as likely poured water on it as his cellmate, that kind of thing goes on as well. So I like to see things very well documented, and this part about being able to secure something, if we're just going to blanketly use those kind of statements, we better get our stuff right. And I'm going to chastise the department on a few other things that bother me in terms of some of these other things I'm going to use to question some of the way the department does things. So is that okay with other members if we pull this one out and try to get more information and details? Because I want to know for sure if we're using this from the department. The letter states specifically, you've been provided with the means to secure all your property. So if that wasn't the case, I want a new letter that states exactly whether or not he did have the opportunity to secure that. And if he did, then I agree with the department. If he didn't, then I'm still going to have questions. So fair enough. All right. The next one I want to go to is item 12, Doc Bob Jones, claim of $15.25. And I actually, DOC, again, the beating loom could have been broken any time, and the offender has no proof it was broken by the corrections staff. Later on, a letter says there was conducted a shakedown and there was no incident reports written regarding a broken beading loom. And members, there was something else I'm trying to find where it was. But it really made me question the whole idea of the shakedown and what exactly can and cannot get damaged in the shakedown process. I know I have it marked in here, but so maybe, Ms. Lind, you could give me a little more information on shakedowns and things getting damaged.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask if our legal counsel, Colby Hudson, can come up here with me. He probably would know a little bit more about shakedowns than I would.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I go through this this Jones claim with you that you had questions on? We didn't have any reports that we conducted a shakedown on that day. And we would have had an incident report or a report stating that we conducted a shakedown, as the offender claimed.
Okay.
And so since we couldn't find anything to prove that we actually did a shakedown on that day, we couldn't commit to breaking the offender's property.
So where does it state there wasn't a shakedown on that day? Some of this is hard to... Because later on, I'm reading a letter on December 28th of 2010 that talks about you did not give the name of the officers who conducted the shakedown, and there's no incident reports, so help me with...
Mr. Chair, I don't have any paperwork on the incident or the shakedown. I just have the offender stating that we did a shakedown. And had we did a shakedown, we would have a report on it.
Well, you're not in, sorry, excuse me, Ms. Lynn, in the letter you're stating to our committee, I don't find in your letter something that states there was no shakedown, just that you didn't have the names of the officers who conducted the shakedown. Is that supposed to mean that there was no shakedown?
Correct. I do not have that letter in front of me.
So, Ms. Lind, help me again. When there is a shakedown, there is a file created that talks about a shakedown?
Correct.
Okay. I think those are the kind of things we need to understand, because many of these claims are stating damage from a shakedown. And I guess there's a handwritten comment here that says there's insufficient evidence that a shakedown occurred. So I don't know what insufficient evidence means.
Michelle Timmons.
Yeah, that, Mr. Chairman, that was my comment.
Right.
In reading through this, and I thought there was insufficient evidence that the shakedown even occurred, and no incident report about breaking the loom. So it was my recommendation to deny the claim. But you may well be correct to question whether or
well,
not
that,
I had
I'm
a
saying you
basis
came
for
to that
my
con-
that's the conclusion I
based
came
on
to
here, but that's why I'm asking her is I don't see anything that says it didn't occur, just that you didn't have a record. So I need to know that if it says that you didn't have names, that you got to tell us there's a record, there's a track of shake. Now we need to understand when we're looking at this thing. You know, maybe other committees didn't read stuff in great detail. I do. I'm weird that way.
Mr. Chair, I have previously provided our policies regarding shakedowns and property and storage.
Okay.
And I can gather all those policies and get those over to the committee.
I don't think members and Ms. Lind, I don't know that we need the full policy, but give us something, simple bullets that we can go back and forth. Because to go back and forth even on our rules sometimes is burdensome, but we do read them before to kind of apply them. But if we can understand in bullet points, and so when we're reading through here and just lay something alongside, because it's very helpful to understand as you're going back and forth on these details. Because I kind of think, too, honestly, when I'm thinking of this, and having been a mayor before as a senator, I look at spending taxpayer dollars like it's my own. And honestly, you know, so I'm going to say this for members here and the rest of the world as well. When I see a claim for $15.25, my honest opinion is it costs way more money to process this claim than $15.25. Pay the guy. Buy him a loon. That's my attitude.
Mr. Chair, I've paid out $6,000 in claims this year already. And so I understand what you're saying with that. And had I known ahead of time the kind of questions that you might have, if you would like to know about shakedowns or other items like that, I could come more prepared for you if you would just let me know ahead of time.
Right.
Because I don't know all the policies.
Right. And that's fair. That's fair, Ms. Lind. I don't mean to sound mean or anything about it, but a lot of these had to do with shakedowns this time, and maybe that's not going to be the case. So maybe the next round, it'll be something else. So if you see, because you're aware of what's coming before us, right?
Correct.
So if you see something that's a common denominator, if you will, then I guess come prepared to just give us the bullet point on the common denominator, or send it with when we go through the pack so we understand. But the policies, as I get, you know, we can read through the policy, and that's what you need the attorney for, to tell us, well, what does a policy mean in detail? But I look at these, and then I won't even comment on the next one after it with a name. You know, it's a horrendous amount of money, and you're going, well, we got to look at these things. But this is for a legal mind here. Okay. So what I'm hearing then, and I'll leave this one alone, you're saying if you don't, or if there was a shakedown that he's claiming broke this, you would for sure have a record of it.
Correct, Mr. Chair. We would have a record of having the shakedown in the first place, which we do not have. And if he would have named some staff names, then we would have contacted those staff members to find out if they know anything in additional. So every time we do a shakedown, there is a record of it. But we did not find a record of ever doing a shakedown within this time period for this offender.
Okay, but it doesn't, I guess maybe your letters aren't clear to me then. And again, the one before this too, it was something in your letter that wasn't clear to me, and that's why I have the questions. So, I mean, this letter doesn't say anything about there not being a shakedown. It says you don't have names, which leads me to believe there must have been a shakedown, but you don't have the names. So I'm just, again, I'm trying to just say I'm very detail-oriented when I read through these. So, okay. So as far as I'm concerned, you've solved that one for me. I'm fine with that. I come to the same conclusion you do on that one. So if everybody else, unless anybody else has another question, that one's, we'll just cross it off because we'll be over. I'm satisfied with that.
Do you want me to talk about this Hollis Larson one?
Yes. That was the one that, I mean, I can read them, but I don't know if I'm coming to a members. That gets to be, that's a lengthy one where.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, Hollis Larson, the next claim is one that I recommended denial on, and it's quite lengthy, as the chairman indicated, and fully litigated in both federal and state courts where the cases were dismissed. But the one thing that bothered me, or that I had a question on in all of this lengthy documentation, is the part of the response, the DOC response, pointing out that the policy for indigent copy requests doesn't state what might be obvious, I don't know, but doesn't say if you please do not attach the documents that you want copied pursuant to the indigent copy request, because if you do, they might get lost. I mean, apparently what happened here is that the original documents were attached to that request. And I had some questions about that whole indigent copy procedure, and why, if it is the case that the DOC really doesn't want those originals attached to the request for the free copying, that maybe, you know, the policy should be explicit. And I don't know if Ms. Lind had time to look at that.
Mr. Chair, we have looked over the paperwork this morning. Colby and I had looked through it, and there's a form that gets attached to the policy, or that the offenders get if they want photocopies. And you are correct in stating that we don't specifically say do not attach your originals to this form. Mm-hmm. But on the form, we just say state the quantity of legal photocopy sheets needed with the case number and the due dates. And you are correct. The policy also says that they can submit a request, and then if that request is approved, then we will let them know, and then they can submit their original documents, and we will copy them at that time.
So from what you're saying, the procedure that would not include attaching originals in the first place is really implied.
Correct.
By the directions on the form.
Correct.
Okay. That answers my question.
All right. I wanted to move on then to Adrian Martinez, number 16 on our this is another one. Claimant alleges responsible for damage to Panasonic headphones. It's an incident of a shakedown. Facility shakedown after they searched my bunk area. I came back to my bunk and had found my Panasonic headphones broke. I feel the staff should have to pay for any damaged property that was committed by correctional staff. I don't know, call me naive, too, but when somebody is making a claim, when you start seeing these huge claims and then you start seeing somebody making a $15 claim, you start thinking for $15, if they're going to take the time, maybe they have a legitimate claim. And again, this is another one. I talked to some other correctional staff, and they said if somebody had a shakedown, that likely they wouldn't have noticed if somebody had headphones in their bunk. They wouldn't have noticed those headphones becoming displaced and being broken, and thus not filing a report, but that's something that could very easily happen in a shakedown. So I guess I questioned that, again, based on some information I was able to obtain from others. And, again, trying to understand this shakedown process. And members, I wish I could find that page where I marked it, because it DOC wrote something about a shakedown, and then something about making the shakedown sounded like it was something very subtle. And I think my LA remembers me going through that specifically. And
careful search was a shakedown.
Yes, something about a careful search. And then I laughed as I was going through it and highlighted it somewhere in here, because I thought, well, what? There's a difference between a careful search and a shakedown in my mind, and what others have explained to me. So maybe Ms. Lind, you could comment on that. I know it's in one of these letters from you, and I will find it and give it to you, because I thought it was a contradiction in terms of careful search and shakedown in the same sentence.
Okay, Mr. Chair, again, I don't really know much about what goes on with the shakedown, and I can give you those procedures or have someone come with me next time that knows the whole process with shakedowns. But one thing is, it's the offender against the staff. So the staff go in there, they perform their shakedown, and from what I know about the shakedowns, they go in there because they think that the offender has been doing something wrong. They have contraband, and so they go in there to check their cell. They go through there, and they write out an incident report. They're supposed to write out an incident report or a shakedown, shakedown letter to show that the shakedown occurred. And the headphones, they could have been damaged before the staff even went in there. I don't know of any staff that will go in there and throw someone headphones to break them on purpose. But again, I can't comment to what actually goes on during a shakedown.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lind. This one met all the other requirements in terms of reported on time. We actually had verification of a shakedown, and I guess in this case I want to pay for the headphones. It's $15. I'm frustrated with seeing all this paperwork on stuff, and this one
Mr. Chair, that pretty good evidence. For these headphones, you're going to be paying for a lot of headphones. A lot of headphones. If you are taking the offender's word that staff broke his headphones, then you're going to have tons. You're going to have three of these books next time that I come here.
Well, maybe, Ms. Lind, but again, I want more details out of DOC. I want specifics in your letters. I don't want letters that, you know, say one thing and mean something else. So I guess I'm telling you, you know, maybe we have to pay for some things. And the rest of the committee can disagree with me. So we might not have to pay for them. This is my opinion. And I was just frustrated with the way this whole system goes. And in terms of the, if what you're saying and what appears on these letters seems to be two different things to me right now.
Mr. Chair, I want to see some details. If you would like to change the way that I do the letters, I have no problem with that. I have no problem sending you more information, getting more details. This is just the way that I've done it for the last 13 years. So I have no problem changing the way that I send letters over.
Okay, and that's great, Ms. Lind, and some of it isn't detailed. So what I just heard you say, so help me if I'm wrong here, that staff never breaks anything? Do we have staff reports of them breaking things?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. That's why I've paid $6,000 in claims so far this year.
Okay.
We have staff that say, yep, we did break his headphones. Let's buy him a new pair. We did break his TV. My biggest issue with claims are our television claims. I pay those constantly.
Okay. Well, then, Ms. Lind, I guess I remember what the next one I pulled out was. I'm going to take your word for it on this one, but I'd actually like to see some of those claims and the documentation of the stuff that you did pay. You could send that over so I could read that for my own edification to understand, especially on these shakedown things. Because, again, when I talk to folks, I will tell you behind the scenes and your legal counsel behind the scenes what people told me that work in the facilities. And we don't want to say it here on record. So it caused me to question some things on what's going on in these reports. So,
Mr. Chairman, I just could maybe add that it is the procedure that it's only the claims that have been denied at the Department of Corrections level that come to the subcommittee. So, you know, there certainly are ones that are paid by the department, and then an example of one that was paid is that Omar Yanez claim, which was on the original agenda, and I had noticed that, in fact, the inventory showed the claimant did have two pairs of tennis shoes at one point, and then upon re-looking at it, Ms. Lind determined to go ahead and pay Mr. Yanez for one pair of tennis shoes that he claimed were lost. So that's an example that was originally on today's agenda where the department did pay a claim. So I know does happen.
And I understand that. I'm not saying that the department doesn't pay claims. I'm not saying there's clear and convincing evidence. But I would like to see how people file reports on shakedowns and what does get damaged, especially the small items. And again, I will tell you, if you'd like to come back to my office and chat about it, about what folks have told me. Because I take this very seriously, and I'm very detail-oriented, and maybe to a fault. So I don't mind behind the scenes. Everybody can tell me how bad I was and how I read between the lines, but I like things to say what they mean and mean what they say. And if that, you know, when I write a letter, I try to use that attitude of writing it in an eighth-grade language so that somebody knows what I mean, and I'm very clear. And sometimes I get faulted for that I don't sound at a higher level of intelligence, but I want to make sure that I'm conveying a message that everyone can understand, and I'm not seeing that on these, and maybe I'm not as smart as my cohorts here. That's very likely, but I like to see it more clear so I get it. Okay? So every time this committee changes, you'll probably find some weird person like me that you'll have to satisfy in changing your letters. I'm not trying to say you don't do a good job. You see this stuff all day long, and God bless you for being able to do it. But when I'm going to read through it, I'm going to try to understand and know what goes on. And again, I made the calls because I took it that serious that some of these things didn't click for me, and it was because of the letters that you wrote in response that they didn't click. Had the letters been simpler, maybe? So for me to understand, I think everything would have clicked and I'd been fine. So I'm sorry to make the committee be indulgent of me today, but it's my day to... I thought it would actually... that I'd go through it quicker, but I'm finding more questions, I guess, than answers sometimes here. The last one I had questions about was Sanders Moore. And this was one I kind of alluded to earlier, the $19.75 in coin. And there's nothing that really supported in terms of inventory and things. So it was more that I wanted to get to understand that with when people are talking about money, is what is the... And again, it can be a bullet point of the when staff packs things up for someone and there's money there. Ms. Lind, you said earlier that folks don't necessarily count it if it's in a jar or a cup or something. I don't know if it's even if there's a wallet there or something else. If they don't count it, do count it. But I guess I'd like to understand that. So that's why I just pulled that out so I could make that comment that I want to understand if they're really, gosh, I don't know what could have happened in this one. If the guy really had the coins, you would think somehow when they're moving the room, they would have found something. So I agreed with you on it, but I wanted to know what the policy was in terms of those sorts of things.
Mr. Chair, we don't have a specific policy for coins or tokens. Our policy is just the offender property and the personal property that says that they're required to store their personal property in the secured areas. So he could take his coins, whether it be in a cup or a box, and put it into his storage area, which would be self-explanatory if you're an offender in a double-bunked cell.
Right. Okay.
I don't have a specific policy regarding staff counting the coins or the tokens. I just know that the offenders are supposed to secure their property when they leave.
Thank you, Ms. Linden. For me to understand... Again, maybe the rest of the committee, it's not an issue, but again, making those calls, I was told those secured areas can be of various sizes depending on the facility.
Correct.
Is that, and so maybe you could help me understand what size areas and what kind of facilities so that when these come before me again, at least I understand.
Right.
I operate out of a different realm than a lot of folks, and it's pretty noticeable sometimes. But I want to visualize, you know, like
Chair,
that TV thing. Could he have stored it in there? Was there an area?
They have storage lockers that they can store. They also have foot lockers that they can lock and put underneath their bunks so that other offenders can't get into their storage areas.
Mm-hmm.
Are you asking me how big a cell is?
No. Okay. Just the types of storage. If it's a...
It's a foot locker with a padlock.
So everyone would have either or both a locker and a foot locker?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Fair enough. So the foot locker is big enough. So like a TV issue, when those come before us, could you get... It seemed that every TV that came before us seemed to be... There was a normal TV that they sold at the facility or something, because when people had receipts, they all seemed to be pretty much the same kind of a television, unless they got it from somewhere else.
Mr. Chair, I think we have 12 inches, 15 inches. I'm not quite sure what the sizes of the televisions are, but I do know that if it was a 12-inch television, they could fit it into their footlocker that goes under the bed. I just don't see any of the offenders locking up their property every time they leave their cell to go to work, to go to school, to go to lunch. So I can't tell you if the bigger TVs will fit into the footlockers.
Okay. Well, it's something you can just look at and vision for me, if it's possible. So when somebody comes before us, that if they suspected their cellmate would do something like that, that they would either A, have the ability or not have the ability. And I think that was the one we pulled to understand that one more. At Hilton, was that
Hilton
a TV one?
Was the TV one.
That was a TV
pulled.
One. So all
yeah.
those issues would go around that yeah. one that we pulled out for next time to be able to understand that. So we're still one shy of a quorum to be able to do anything.
I'm just curious on when. Another for Nicole, Linda, I believe.
On the
property, you know, on the coins, you know, there's some reference to a serious medical condition. Is the money going to be used to address that? There seems to be an allegation. Serious medical condition due to negligence could result in permanent damage after surgery, and it mentions a sister, president, and et cetera. Where's that going?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
And maybe Ms. Lynn doesn't have a copy of that.
Is it an injury claim?
No, it's in that coin issue, in the handwritten letter, in response, I don't know if we want to just give her a copy of the letter. The last paragraph talks about something about the officer is doing something wrong, and the sister works in the Pentagon, knows President Obama personally, and he's being sent money because they know he has a serious medical condition, and due to the officer's negligence, I may have permanent damage after my surgery. So I, it wasn't in the claim, but he was alleging something else was going on there in that last paragraph. So we don't know if you had dealt with that, Ms. Lind, or if there's anything forthcoming on another claim that would be in regard to that last paragraph.
Okay, I just, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I just found this kite, and you're asking me about the last paragraph, and what was your question on that?
That was your question. Senator Wieger was, is...
Any other, are we on notice of another claim?
Is there another claim forthcoming that this explanation letter would be part of, because he's alleging some negligence on the staff officers, that he might have permanent damage after surgery? Do we know anything about that, or is...
If he is alleging anything that has to do with an injury or permanent damage, that would be an injury claim with Randy Hartnett, and I haven't heard of any injury claims regarding this offender yet.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lind. But it was I noticed that too, Senator Wieger, that I didn't know if that was a preamble to something that was coming in the future, or...
Kind of alluded to that at the beginning.
Right. Okay, and then Representative Simon actually wanted us to look at another one. The Robert Smith.
Mr. Chairman, this is a claim in which an inmate was transferred to Virginia on February 4th of 2009, and then a letter arrived back in Minnesota in May of 2010 to inquire about the property, which never arrived in Virginia. And when I looked at this, I jumped to the bottom line and thought that was that 15-month delay was determinative, and I made the recommendation to deny it. Representative Simon had some specific questions, though, about the DOC response. And he said in his email of Sunday that the claimant waited too long. That fact alone could justify denial of the claim. But the DOC should clarify its policy. Is an offender entitled to have his personal property follow him out of state? If not, why not? And does the DOC make offenders aware of its policy? He says the staff recommendation to deny the claim may well be the correct result, but he expresses that he's troubled by DOC's policy positions that he's seeing as contradictory. And that was Representative Simon's question on this one.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lind.
What happens with offenders that transfer out of state? They work closely with their caseworker, and they go through all the procedures, what's going to happen and what's going to happen with your property, And with this claim, Rush City did pack up his property and they sent it to Oak Park Heights. And apparently Oak Park Heights lost the paper trail from there. We don't have a paper trail for his property, so I'll admit to that. And then when he's in Virginia, what happens is any allowable property that Virginia will allow him to have, we will ship to Virginia. And if we do not have an allowable property list from Virginia, we ship everything to Virginia, and they can go through and tell the offender what he's allowed to have and what he needs to ship out. In this case, I can only assume that we sent the paperwork along with the property to Virginia, and that is how we lost our paper trail of his property. And the one thing I wanted to mention with the 15 months is this offender was allowed certain items from our DOC to come into the Virginia DOC, and it just seemed kind of awkward that he would wait 15 months to notice that he didn't have any of his personal property. Because to me, if I'm an offender in Virginia and I notice that I don't have my property, I'm going to notice that immediately. I'm not going to wait 15 months.
But you have a written policy on that that we can get back for Representative Simon?
Yes, I did print out the policy.
Oh, you did print out that policy. Okay. Other question, when we were dealing with a number of these, it said no amount given. Though we read through the claims, does one assume that they're hoping we come up with an idea of help for them? Or
Can you indicate which claim you're...
Well, there's a number of claims here that we have in our packet that say no amount given.
That's something that I write on the sheet. Nicole doesn't write that on there. Usually it's that there is not an amount indicated on her letter that she sends to me, or that there's no indication on the offender's claim itself. So I think we assume that, you know, we're going to assign some kind of value if we were to accept it.
Well, as I'm asking Ms. Lind, I'm assuming that when it gets forwarded to us, there's no specified amount of damages that the inmate at that point forwards it, hoping that we would come up with something? Or
that's why I was asking you if you could point one out for me.
Well, one was that Robert Smith one was one. David Stanton. Those were two right together that had no... no amount given. Is there more than that in this package?
Mr. Chair, on a lot of these claims, they just want the cost of the television to replace it. And so you're correct in assuming that if I was going to replace their television, I would call the canteen and find out how much that television was worth. If I justified paying it, I would call them and find out. But in certain situations here where I deny it, I don't do that, but I could in the future if that's something that you want me to investigate further, even though I recommend denying it.
Well, no, that's fine. I just made that assumption that we were supposed to look at what we were given and come up with an amount if we were going to award them something.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Chair, but if that was something that if you looked at the packet ahead of time and had a question on it, then I could get that amount for you and look into it further.
Okay, great. There's one other question I was... Oh, I know what this was when I was thinking when we were looking at some of these. Again, getting back to what you do internally when you do pay some of these, just to understand, and again, I guess I'm asking the rest of the committee to indulge me. So is there cases like, let's say, on a television where you don't know but you don't have a good answer, so you meet somebody partway with something? I mean, is there something that comes before you where you have to make that decision that, well, my folks didn't tell me a lot. Something seems fuzzy to me on both ends here, so I'm going to meet the person partway and pay for part of a television. Does that happen as well?
Sure, absolutely. We have a claims officer at the facility that actually investigates the claims and gathers all the documentation. And then they forward it to me, and I look through it, and I ask them for more information, or I contact someone over in property. And if we do not have, if we don't follow our own policy by filling out the inventory, the exit inventory, the intake inventory, most of those claims are paid because we did not follow our own policy.
Okay, great. So a lot of that is just really, I guess, more questions I have is understanding, you know, how your job works and what goes on. So I don't know, I'm assuming the rest of the committee, that's the one thing I do try to follow is your inventory sheets. And, you know, that's a great way to tell whether something is logged or not. And it is always curious when you see it logged somewhere and it disappears somewhere else. And so I guess it raises more questions for us sometimes on that basis, too, is, you know, what happens in between. How do let's go back to a ring. A ring is on one inventory sheet and it disappears off another one. Do people lose a lot of things in prison?
Mr. Chair, they actually sell a lot of things in prison.
Okay.
They use their personal property to gain other items. And our inventories would try to be very specific what was in the cell on this day. And if it wasn't in the cell on another day, we can only assume that it was lost or that they sold it to someone else or they traded it. So that I agree with you with the inventory. That is exactly, we need the inventories filled out. We need to follow our policy and have those inventories available.
And I don't know if the rest of the members seemed that, like I made the mention earlier, it seemed like the hot pots and the sweatpants were hot items to be buying and selling or something, because they seemed to be the ones that were disappearing off more of these than anything else.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to do when we can't officially act on.
Right, Mr. Chairman. I was just thinking about that. It seems like the summary from these property claims, if I'm correct, is that the only one you were going to hold over was number 10.
It was number
Orville 10. Helton.
Orville Helton. And really, I wanted to understand again, Ms. Lind, and I'm sorry, sir, you didn't identify yourself. Were you the legal counsel?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kobe K. Hudson. I'm Associate General Counsel for the DOC, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. I guess the question that I was holding this one over for really was the DOC letter, if you look at it in this case, stated that he had the ability to secure the television. And so my question really to answer before we release that one is, based on that letter, did he have the ability to secure that television or not?
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hudson.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm not well-versed in this particular claim, so I'm not conversant with all the facts here. But as Ms. Lind alluded to earlier, depending on the size of the TV that an offender has in possession, he may or may not be able to store it within a footlocker or one of the other lockers that are provided to offenders. What I can say is that based on what I heard transpire earlier, we do have inmates who are, in some instances, double bunked. The department takes great precautions to avoid offender incompatibilities. It's bad for the offenders, obviously. It's bad for business, for DOC. It's bad for security in the facility. And so when an incompatibility is reported, whether that's to one of the line COs or to the warden or whomever, it is taken seriously, it is investigated, and where possible, it is rectified, and in many instances, offenders are separated because of an incompatibility. But if we are not on notice of an existing incompatibility, and if that were the case here, we would not necessarily take extra efforts to sit on the offender's property while he's out of his cell. The assumption is that in the absence of such a report, there would not be a need for us to guard his property while he's away from the cell.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. And to Mr. Hudson and Ms. Lind, even to simplify, on some of these letters, I don't know that we need great detail. Even bullet points for us work as to the policies. And the rest of the committee could decide even that we shouldn't pull this, that we should just deny it. I can be overridden. But it was a DOC letter that that led me to want to look at it more, because I made the assumption that there was incompatibility because the letter stated clearly that he had the ability to secure the television and did not. And so I was relying on that. And so if he could have secured it, if he had the room, committee members, and he didn't secure it, heck, the thing's over for me. You know, you deny it. But if there was, I assumed the incompatibility, because otherwise why would the letter state that he should have secured it? I don't know. So I made some assumptions based on what the letter said.
Respectfully, so, Mr. Chair, we could very well agree that perhaps this was inartfully stated. However, again, if an incompatibility is reported and investigated, obviously we would take steps to protect both the offenders involved and their property. And what rises to the level of incompatibility may depend on the day. Two cellmates who get along quite well one day might wake up the next day and one of them decides he's not in a very good mood with the other, and for whatever reason, they have an argument. This may or may not rise to the level of an incompatibility, but again, we can only respond to what is reported to us. But I agree. If to the extent there are matters that are perhaps incompletely or inartfully stated, we're happy to address those in our letters.
Members, how do you guys feel? If you feel that we should just deny it, I'm fine with keeping it in. And I think the way we should at least wrap this up is to say that, you know, we've all agreed on whatever we come up with today and have that as a conclusion. I think we would have to come back into a full committee, though, to... But at least the other two members would know our conclusions at that point, so that's how I'd like to wrap.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's what I was going to suggest, that I don't believe you can actually act to deny these today because we don't have a quorum from the House of Representatives as stated in the rules of procedure for the committee. However, I would think that this group could recommend that at the next meeting, either all of these property claims be denied or you know, if you wanted to recommend the bulk of them and pull one or two out as you for to be laid over and rediscussed at the next meeting. I think you can certainly make that
recommendation. I think our other option is, I would understand, so help me through this. So if we knew that there was meetings going on here at the Capitol and we could get us all together, if the other two members knew, that's why I want to let them know what we were thinking, we could gavel in a meeting to to finish that conclusion off without having a formal other meeting because we went through the process on these things to come to a conclusion. So, Senator Newman?
My position, Mr. Chairman, would be to deny all of the DOC claims. I'm not real interested in going back and rehashing them in the future. So that would be my request and recommendation.
Senator Wieger?
I concur.
I concur as well.
All right. As you see, though I would like some more information to understand, next time we're not going to pull that file. I'm outnumbered on the committee members, and we will concur that all the DOC property claims should be denied as set forth before us. So that is our conclusion, though we can't officially act on that today. So you can just give me more information so I understand at later dates. But
Mr. Chair, committee, absolutely.
Ms. Lind?
Absolutely. I'm sorry. Absolutely.
So then we had...
Just these two.
And we have people here to how does that work if we have people here to testify and we don't have... can we still... Take a testimony entered into record and...
Absolutely, okay. Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'm curious.
Respectfully, Mr. Chair, we've tried to call him both at his office on his cell phone, emailed him. We just have not been able to. I guess according to his LA, he was aware of the meeting. I talked to his LA actually last week and... You know, she seemed like she knew about it, and it was on his calendar. So I'm just not sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Lind and Mr. Hudson. We appreciate it. I did learn a lot So thank you for indulging me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, so we have Chris Simondet. Is Chris Simondet here? Am I saying that right?
Mr. Chair, it's actually a woman, Jessica Kennedy, from the Department of Human Services.
Okay, so Department of Human Services, and on that case. Okay, so if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Would you like me to have some preliminary remarks on that?
Yes.
Mr.
Yes,
Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives and senators, my name is Jessica Kennedy, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to have Ms. Timmons give us some preliminary
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What I wanted to say as a preliminary comment here is that in, again, in observing the claims subcommittee and Mr. Lindeke for several years, the Department of Human Services in recent years had taken a very strong position that no claims should be paid because of the law that says in the tort liability law that there is no liability for property claims from inmates of institutions, including the Department of Human Services. What's happened with these two claims that is different is that in both cases, the department is offering the claimants an internal administrative process to try to resolve the claims. So in other words, what I'm saying is that the Department of Human Services has created a new procedure that's much more similar to the procedure the Department of Corrections has used for all of those claims that we just finished discussing, where there were internal procedures, some were paid, only the ones that were not paid came to this committee for further discussion. So in light of that, I mean, there are certainly specifics on each one of these claims, but the department has recommended that you deny the claims, give them an opportunity to do the internal procedure, and then if the claimants are not satisfied, they would be able to refile the claims, although that would have to be taken by a vote and action with a quorum, much like the denial of the DOC property claims that we just went through.
So that's the administrative forum process?
Right. Now, and another option would be to simply lay these over and await and, you know, wait and see, have the department report back to you as to what happened with the administrative procedure. And you, given the lack of a quorum and or your desire as to how much oversight you might want to have with this new procedure, that would be an alternative.
Okay, so trying to understand, so these folks were offered this and chose to forward it to the claims committee?
I don't believe that's the case. Perhaps Ms. Kennedy can.
Ms. Kennedy, can you explain what was offered to these folks in terms of an administrative forum to solve the problem?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that opportunity. I can. In both of these claims, they both come from the same state-operated facility in which the patient's rights advisor is the same. And the woman erroneously advised the two patients to first file the claim with the LCC, with their subcommittee, before taking advantage of the internal administrative forum.
So I think the right process then would be to table these to allow the internal process to work. Would that be the correct in your mind for us to table these two items until your internal process has a chance to work?
Mr. Chair, that is consistent with our recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. I don't think we can officially table them, but we can recommend tabling these two items until the process has a chance to work. So we're all in agreement on that. And I believe that's our full agenda for today.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, unless several of the members mentioned concerns or questions about the Sherburne County matter that was to be first on the agenda, and I just wondered if there was anything more that you wanted staff to do or anything that we should prepare on those, on that for the next meeting.
Senator Weaver.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Ms. Timmons, I spoke to Pat Finnegan, the attorney at the Department of Revenue, and to see what precedent there is for making a reimbursement to applicants where the law has changed, whether it's the cap or anything else. But if there's any research on that, and also, what's the impact if we approve this for other soil and water conservation districts similarly situated? We didn't know that, but I assume the floodgate opens.
Exactly. Good question, Senator Weaver. I further thought that this was interesting because we are asked to reimburse something that wasn't paid to the state as well. It was paid to the Board of Soil and Water Conservation District, and I didn't think that that was a correct application of anything legal.
Yeah, 'cause I wondered if they even had standing.
So I guess that's what
it's a governmental unit.
What our question would be, is there precedent to do this? And further, is there any standing, I guess, to request a reimbursement for something that we were never paid for to begin with as a state?
Yes, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Weaver, I can do some research on that. And certainly the only case during the time I observed the committee, subcommittee, and Mr. Lindeke that was somewhat similar was one in which there was a change in the law regarding what had to be on the title for automobiles, motor vehicles that had been damaged either in accidents or hail damage, that sort of thing. And there were a number of vendors who dealt with these used vehicles that had had damage who came into the subcommittee claiming that because there was a change in the law, that they suffered damage because they purchased vehicles with damage before the law changed as to what information was noted on the titles. And so now what they had was worth less than what they thought they were getting when they purchased the vehicles under the old law. And so I can do a bit of a write-up of perhaps about that claim. It's not directly on point with this one, but it was similar in that the claimants were claiming damages as a result of a change in statute. And the subcommittee on claims at that time really felt it would be establishing a problematic precedent to grant the claim, and the claim was denied. So I can get pull that detail and write that up for the next meeting.
Anything further, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Timmons, that what you were just addressing is the exactly, I think, what Senator Weaver was asking for, some kind of precedent.
Yeah.
I would like to see that. Yeah. Also, if you could provide us with copies of the old and the new law, I could certainly find it myself.
Sure.
But we've got a site here for a recent change in the law, so we can compare that. And then the last thing would be the letter from the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District dated June 6th to the landowner. It says, thank you for choosing the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District to assist you. If you could maybe be in a position to tell me a little bit of background. I've never seen this before. And apparently the landowner has got an option of choosing the conservation district. I'm just wondering where that's coming from. I didn't understand it.
Representative Wardlow. Were you done, Senator?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Here's my questions exactly. It appears to me, and maybe we can get confirmation on this, that the, first of all, that it was the Sherburne County Soil and Water Conservation District's option to write the CAPs in the first instance, that there could have been other people that would do this. Not clear whether the law actually requires them to charge a fee at all. They decided to do that on their own. They also decided to refund the fee, and there's no requirement about that either.
Right.
So it seems like this is all optional conduct.
Thank you, Representative. I believe you're right on that. In it was their decision to make a refund based on the law change, I think, is the clear part we need to understand. We didn't ask anyone to make a decision, nor did we receive any of those funds to begin with. So I don't see a standing for that to be a claim to even come through here, but I don't know. Okay, so if we've got that settled, what we want Ms. Timmons
Mr. Chairman.
To come up with. Then to recap, what we've come up with today was to basically recommend to our fellow representatives here that are missing today that on item 3, the claims against Minnesota Department of Human Services, that those items be tabled until the internal administrative process could work. And we've all agreed, based on their agreement, that all claims against the Department of Corrections, that we agree with the Department of Corrections that all claims be denied. So I would ask that would be what our record is for today's meeting. If there's no further business, the claims committee is adjourned.
Mr. Chair, just tentatively, when do we plan on consummating this?
I'm not certain, Senator Weger, but if there's any days when we might all meet and I don't, before our next meeting, that we're at the Capitol or I see a number of people here, I'll try to make some calls. I'll have Neil watch our schedules for the different caucuses to see if a number of us might be around and then call others to be able to get
January.
Folks here. I'm assuming it's going to be January now with the holidays.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless anybody has anything right before Christmas where they're going to come and set in goals, but I don't think our Republican caucus has anything like that going on. So,
exactly.
Looks like January.